read verses 1 through 5. Since the essence, there are several places in the Bhagavatam where appropriately the Bhagavatam could end, because there's a flow, questions and answers flow, and then the answers are completed. So the Bhagavatam could be 3 chapters long. But fortunately for us, there are expert receivers of the Bhagavatam. We discussed a little bit yesterday the qualification of rapt attention and eagerness to hear. So you put those two things together, and what flows is, after hearing, there's further questioning. And Prabhupada even indicated like this, not to. It's just a nice instruction. A sign of that one has heard is that there are further questions. Not that a sign that one has heard is there's no questions. A sign that there's heard, that is, I'd like to go more deeply in a certain subject matter. I'm excited about this subject matter. Can it be explained further? And that's one type of question that comes in the Bhagavatam. For example, when describing the appearance of Vritrasura, how Vishvarup, the spiritual master of the demigods, particularly King Indra, was killed by Indra. Maharaj Pariksit says, stop, stop, wait. Can you go over that again? How did that happen? How was Brihaspati is the spiritual master, and how did Vishvarupa, and he killed the spiritual master? And could you explain that more? And then after hearing the whole thing, he asked another question. How did Vritrasura, who was a demon, exhibit such elevated qualities? How did he exhibit the qualities of a perfected soul? How did that happen? So, hearing, done properly, leads to, in an inquisitive spirit, expanding the subject matter. So, Shaunaka is one such person. He's hearing from Sutta, and you'll see from how he speaks, he's excited. Sutta, Mahabhago. Describe more. Oh, this is so nice. Or Maharaj Pariksit, hearing from Shukadeva Goswami. He asks some questions, and Shukadeva Goswami answers his questions, and it could be class is over, or Bhagavatam is over. But it continues because of the qualification of both parties. And that's a theme. How is transcendental knowledge transmitted? Qualified person transmitting, qualified receiver. So we're hearing from a variety of scenes, what's the qualification of the speaker? What's the qualification of the listener? There's a relationship, and what's the nature of that relationship? Just like spiritual master, in this nice book that Shubhananda compiled from Prabhupada's teachings on the role of the spiritual master, there's indications of what's the qualification of the spiritual master and the duties of the spiritual master, the qualifications of the disciple and the duties of the disciple, and then you put those two together and you have guru-disciple relationship. Because it's a relationship. It's not one way or one way, it's a relationship. So what's the qualification that we have to receive the message of Srimad Bhagavatam? And how does that qualification, in a suitable expression, how does that take shape? So Shonaka is showing us by his example. So text 1, chapter 4. On hearing Sutta Goswami speak thus, Shonaka Muni, who is the elderly, learned leader of all the rishis engaged in that prolonged sacrificial ceremony, congratulated Sutta Goswami by addressing him as follows. So, Prabhupada in the purport highlights what are Shonaka's qualifications. When there's an assembly, there's a speaker and there's assembly, and someone representing the assembly, what's the qualification of that person representing the assembly? The qualifications should be as follows. He must be the leader of the house and an elderly man. This is culture. So the others of the assembly accept. He is a person who we look up to. And elderly, vastly learned, these are the three that are mentioned. And so he, on behalf of the audience, spoke. And his appreciation for Sutta's qualification is that Sutta is going to express his realization of what he heard. Then Prabhupada very carefully assesses, what does that mean? Like sometimes we have discussion groups on scripture, and we read something and then we begin discussing it. And sometimes what happens, particularly with less experienced devotees, is the discussion starts going all over the universe about, I read something 15 years ago about blah, 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 blah. And then someone says, oh, I thought blah, 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 blah. And you just, the message of disciplic succession just vanished, and one goes into the realm of thoughts of scholarly people and things like that. So that's a disqualification. And the qualification of Sutta is, he said, Vyas compiled, he taught to Shukadev, I heard from Shukadev, and by his mercy, hearing with rapt attention, I assimilated this message. And yata ditam yata mati, Prabhupada refers that to in chapter 4. I learned it from him, and I have realized it. Then Prabhupada explains, what is realized it mean? What is presenting something according to one's realization? Here's what Prabhupada writes. Here's first what not to do. One should not show off one's erudition out of vanity, attempting to surpass the previous acharya. Rather, he must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time he must realize the subject matter so nicely that, so here's item number one under realization, present the matter for the particular circumstance in a suitable manner. So you know your audience, and according to the audience, let's say you have children, you can present the message of Srimad Bhagavatam to children, but it should be in language in a manner presented that they can to some degree relate. and then so on, depending upon audience. So now in italics, Prabhupada puts, what does in a suitable manner mean? It means that the original purpose of the text must be maintained. Suitable to the audience, but the essence is maintained. This is discussed a little bit in Nectar Devotion, where Prabhupada explains that Rupa Goswami has presented principles, not details, and he gives an example. For example, that there's a principle that one must take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master, that's a principle, and the detail is the spiritual master may instruct the disciple to do this, another disciple to do that, and that's a detail. But there's that relationship must be established, that's a principle. That doesn't change. Principles don't change. When you're presenting according to your own realization, principles don't change. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. And it goes the other direction. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it. Yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. This is called realization. Some time ago I had a direct experience of this phenomena of people expecting that a good speaker screws out new meanings that aren't there. I was attending a Bengali program. And I guess these people had been accustomed to reading Swami Vivekananda's writings and Dr. Radhakrishna's writings. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to do basics. And I did, you know, a Bhagavad Gita 101 class with this group of people. And at the end, one elderly man said, could you give some different meanings? He didn't exactly use that language, but something like that. Something. What are some other meanings that one could take from this? Like he just wanted, that was like nectar for him, to hear speculation. This is what he was accustomed to. And he was a little surprised when I said, we don't do that. There's a direct meaning, and we take the direct meaning. And this means this, not that. So we talk about this, and we don't just screw up that meaning. We don't do that. It's Bhagavad Gita as it is. When Krishna says, he means what he says. If he meant something else, he would say something else, and we'd speak something else. But this is what he said. There's in one of the items of devotional service mentioned in Nectar Devotion, similar to what's being said here, is one should not read many books with the purpose, as a speaker, that you will embellish the subject with so many other subject matters, and then for that purpose gain some appreciation that, oh, he's a nice speaker. I mean, Prabhupada was very, very strong in upholding that principle. He would speak very, very fundamental things with realization, with so many different applied meanings so that his audience, us, would very clearly understand it. And he didn't go all over the place with so many embellishments. Now, embellishments are nice, but the one should be sure to maintain the essences. So therefore, when Shonaka heard Sutta say, yataditam, yatamati, that I'm presenting it as I've realized it, he was very glad. Oh, very nice. And he jumped up. And he, on behalf of the whole audience, he spoke, "Oh, Suta Goswami, you are the most fortunate and respected of those who can speak and recite. Please. Katam Bhagavatim Punyam. Please relate the pious message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yad Aha Bhagavan Shukaha," which was spoken by the great and powerful sage Shukadeva Goswami. Here's an example in this fourth chapter where Shuka is also addressed as Bhagavan. Now Prabhupada has spoken very strongly and clearly on this. Bhagavan is appropriate for Krishna. But one who is the special usage here is because he's so dear to Krishna, he's addressed as Bhagavan. We could say maybe Bhagyavan. He's received the mercy of Bhagavan, so he's Bhagyavan. But he's giving some special honor. Krishna is Bhagavan. But Shukadev is very, very qualified. Suta Mahabhago Vada No Vadatam Vara. Please speak this message. And he's exhibiting his eagerness to hear. He's exhibiting also his recognition of Suta Goswami's qualifications. Then he starts his specific questions. There's three verses worth of that. In what period and at what point, at what place was this first begun and taken up? How did this Srimad Bhagavatam initially make its appearance? From where did Krishna Dvaipaya Vyasa, the great sage, get the inspiration to compile this literature? His son, Vyasadeva's son, was a great devotee, an equibalanced monist, whose mind was always concentrated in monism. He was transcendental to mundane activities, but being unexposed, he appeared like an ignorant person. He wants to know about the book itself and how it appeared. He wants to know about Shukadeva Goswami's receiving and carrying that message when he was already self-realized. Prabhupada is speaking about Shukadeva Goswami. He was a liberated soul, and thus he remained always alert not to be trapped by the illusory energy. In the Bhagavad Gita, this alertness is very lucidly explained. The liberated soul and the conditioned soul have different engagements. The liberated soul is always engaged in the progressive path of spiritual attainment, which is something like a dream for the conditioned soul. The conditioned soul cannot imagine the actual engagements of the liberated soul. While the conditioned soul thus dreams about spiritual engagements, the liberated soul is awake. Similarly, the engagement of the conditioned soul appears to be a dream for the liberated soul. Conditioned soul and the liberated soul may apparently be on the same platform, but factually they are differently engaged, and their attention is always alert, either in sense enjoyment or in self-realization. It's like we were discussing yesterday evening, the eagerness to hear, this, in another way of saying, is alertness. So, free will is the selector of where we invest consciousness. It says, you know, it's our value system. And a mode of goodness person puts their attention on ethics, morals, and things that they value about a good life, the way a good person should live, and that's the path they follow. And a materialist, let's say a fruitive worker person, they want the fruit, they want profit, they want distinction, they want adoration, they want enjoyment of the senses. Gross. Mode of goodness person wants the enjoyment of a subtle sense of contentedness, happiness, conditioned by a kind of mode of goodness, happiness. They like that. And so they pursue activities that bring that happiness. The mode of ignorance has another objective. Sleep, intoxication, anger. Some people are not happy unless they're angry. They find some issue with somebody or something and get into it. So that's investing of consciousness in the modes of nature type. And the human form of life is the alert to self-realization. As far as a materialist is concerned, that's a complete waste of time. What is this self-realization? It's just, you can't cope with realities of life, and so you zone out in twinkle land and waste your time. So that's night for the materialist, which is daytime for the transcendentalist, and vice versa. So where we choose to place our consciousness determines the qualities that we carry. Like, you know, we're conditioned, in one sense, we're conditioned by the modes of nature, that Bhagavad Gita explains. But we can change that by free will choices of choosing different kind of association than that which is coming our way by material conditioning. We can choose to associate with transcendentalists and choose to try to see the hand of Krishna and understand the will of Krishna and the plan of Krishna, or to do Krishna's work, whatever the circumstance. It's like reading a novel sometimes for me when I travel with a plane load of materialistic people, because each one is absorbed in their thing. Like this thing that happened the other night, of it was what was supposed to be like an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minute flight turned out to be an 8 hour nightmare. And then the nature of people was coming out. There's the social nice, and then there's the anger, frustration, indulgences, you know. The character of people just became evidenced, and the mode of nature that the individual associates with comes out just due to circumstance. So it was like a Charles Dickens novel or something, just watching these different personalities exhibiting their personalities, completely conditioned by the modes of nature. So a circumstance came that way that instead of going straight, it was U-turn, and they didn't know what to do but exhibit the conditioning influence. So a devotee, on the other hand, you know, just by training, one can see illusion, then the varieties of illusion, then reality. And reality is like the lady sitting, the elderly lady sitting next to me. She just kept saying, "Bad luck. Bad luck." And you know, we got to a place where she could make a call and calling her people. So, bad luck. Make sure the room is, because, you know, got to our places at 2 o'clock in the morning and everything shut down. So, by association and by training and by the light of the Bhagavatam, a devotee can see the path to self-realization in any circumstance. It may not be exactly, we know, oh, okay, now this where that foot goes and that's where that foot goes because the path is so clear. But the goal of self-realization is the arrangement that Krishna makes for each of us in different ways. Each of us have our different situations and challenges and opportunities and things. But the path of self-realization is where there's eagerness. And if, like what's happening here, these are sages that are gathered for 1,000 years to perform a yajna, and here comes Suta Goswami, who has heard from Shukadeva Goswami in such a qualified way, he's realized that they're jumping up. Eagerness for self-realization, because we want it ourselves and we want that for others. Suta, please deliver. Tell us. Shukadeva Goswami is such a qualified person. He is always fixed in transcendence. He has no interest at all in mundane. Whatever he did, we want to hear what he did and what he said. We're very eager. Then to additionally speak about how qualified Shukadeva Goswami is, this next verse, and it's a cultural item, but it's also a transcendental message. While Sri Vyasadeva was following his son, so Shukadeva Goswami was born, and at once he left home, 16 years old. While Sri Vyas was following his son, beautiful young damsels who were bathing naked covered their bodies with cloth, although Sri Vyasadeva himself was not naked. But they had not done so when his son had passed and he was naked. The sage, Vyas, inquired about this, and the young ladies replied that his son was purified and when looking at them made no distinction between male and female, but the sage made such distinctions. It's interesting that this is put right here when they're describing, you know, hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the qualification of Shukadeva Goswami, but it goes to the qualification of Shukadeva Goswami. He was 16-year-old boy, as Prabhupada says. His physiognomy was fully developed, and he was naked. And he's walking down the street, 16-year-old boy. And he's passing by a lake where the ladies are bathing. They're also naked. And they just say, you know, Shukadeva Goswami's passing. Just... they didn't know who he was, but a young naked boy walking down the street. They didn't cover themselves. But here comes Vyas running after the boy, fully clothed, and they cover themselves. So, the ladies, as far as Vyas is concerned, the ladies, by their special qualifications, could see the innocence of Shukadeva Goswami, and therefore they were not very concerned about him. But when his father passed, the ladies quickly dressed. The ladies were exactly like his children or grandchildren, yet they reacted in the presence of Vyasadeva according to the social custom because Srila Vyasadeva played the part of a householder. A householder has to distinguish between a male and female, otherwise he cannot be a householder. Kind of obvious. One should therefore attempt to know the distinction between body and soul without attachment for male and female. So here's now what we're supposed to take out of this little description. While we're on the path of recognizing our real identity as spirit soul, not this body, going along with that is some detachment from the otherwise worldly distinctions of male and female. Prabhupada writes, as long as such distinctions are there, one should not try to become a sannyasi like Shukadeva Goswami. At least theoretically, one must be convinced that a living entity is neither male nor female. So there's that verse in Bhagavad Gita, Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hasini Shuni Chayave Sapakicha Pandita Samadarshana. In explaining that verse, Prabhupada elaborated that the Pandita, the learned person, sees the spirit soul, and because of seeing the spirit soul, samadarshanam, one sees with equal vision. Then Prabhupada explained, it's not that the behavior towards all living entities is the same, although the vision is, spiritually, they're equal. The example he gave is, if one sees a tiger, one doesn't go and embrace the tiger, because he's a tiger, and his instinct, when in the presence of food, is he'll eat it. So we don't go and embrace the tiger. So behavior may be different, it will be different, but still seeing is on the same platform, samadarshana. Seeing on the spiritual platform, behaving appropriate for the circumstance. Just like the speaker, the realization of the qualified speaker. He knows his audience, he knows the subject, and he presents the subject according to the capacity and nature of the audience. That qualified speaker should be self-realized in an ideal sense. So seeing on a spiritual platform, acting deferentially according to the circumstance. The outward dress, this body, is made of matter by material nature to attract the opposite sex and thus keep one entangled in material existence. A liberated soul is above this perverted distinction. So that we're not like misunderstanding Vyasadeva's position, Prabhupada concludes, Vyasadeva was also in the transcendental stage. But he was in the householder's life, so he did not pretend to be a liberated soul as a matter of custom. Pretend meaning take on the role of a renunciate when he was a householder. So, what does this mean for all of us? What are we to understand? On the path of cultivating Krishna consciousness, and particularly moving about in the world, but seeing with spiritual vision, with spiritual conception, we're minimally at least to try to recognize the equal position of all living beings because of their spiritual nature, the spirit soul that's within the body, and recognize the real person is not the body, nor the behaviors, nor the mentality. All of that is conditioning. It's covering of the soul. We can recognize the different types of covering, that's okay. But we relate to the person as a soul. And we particularly respect a devotee of the Lord because here's a soul, whatever their conditioning may be, they have some attraction for Krishna. They're trying to reconnect with Krishna. So that's, on the soul platform, that's very special. Then on the material platform, there's differences. And our service is to put Krishna in the center and attract that soul and everyone that we come in contact with toward Krishna in an appropriate way. And the community of Vaishnava Sangha here at Penn State or wherever the medium that you're interacting with is Krishna goes at the center and here's various spirit souls. Some are in male bodies, some are in female bodies. We have different roles according to our situation. And we just serve cooperatively. We stay within our role, although that's not who we are. We act in an appropriate manner according to position, our embodiment or our psychophysical nature. We act appropriately, respecting the differences that are there and particularly appreciating the attraction, the common attraction for Krishna. So we act in such a way the common attraction for Krishna will be enhanced. Trying to keep our attention on the spiritual platform while we're recognizing differences and acting appropriately. So Prabhupada called this Daivi Varnashram. We have duties appropriate to our varna and ashram, and we do them, but we put Krishna at the center. So now back to the text. Its sutta is glorifying Shukadeva Goswami. What a speaker. Oh, what a speaker. Just see what, you want to know what kind of a person, Shukadeva Goswami was way up here. And not only my opinion, look at these naked ladies in the lake. When he came by, he was also naked and just, they just continued, just without any concern. And then when his father came by, their behavior changed. Recognizing, oh, you're a householder. It's our duty. It's just custom. It's social custom. Our shyness should be exhibited. But Shukadeva Goswami was like a child in his innocence. Because he's not making such distinctions. So it's a glorification of Shukadeva Goswami. And it's the person that's on his platform of complete absorption and transcendence. When he speaks the Srimad Bhagavatam, must have been wonderful, please tell us. So it's the emerging of the topic. How did Srimad Bhagavatam come into being? From where and when? How did Vyasa put it all together? He taught it to Shukadeva Goswami. What a nectarian way Shukadeva Goswami must have presented it, and you heard it and you realized it. Tell us more. And so the chapter goes into how Vyasa compiled the Bhagavatam and all of the Vedas. So that's an important understanding for the reader of the Bhagavatam. Where does it fit into the whole of the Vedic picture, all the Vedic literature? it's been described as the cream in the beginning, cream of Vedic literature, the incarnation of Godhead. So how did, just like we ask how to describe the activities of Varahadev, how did he appear, or Vamana, his appearance and his activities. So it's like that, describing the appearance and the activities of the Bhagavatam, how the Bhagavatam was presented to the world. Okay. Any comments or questions?
How is it that Shukadeva Goswami, who was the first recipient of Bhagavatam, who was a monist to begin with, was more qualified than Srila Vyasadeva, who was the compiler of Bhagavatam and also who was Vedic literature and also actually Shakti Vishakta? Could Shukadeva Goswami be more qualified to speak to that? When Vyasadeva was present in that assembly?
The answer to that question has to do with who Shukadeva Goswami was before he was Shukadeva Goswami. And Brahma Vivarta Purana describes he was Srimati Radharani's parent. And there's a detailed explanation. So he appeared to assist in the manifesting of the Bhagavatam. The detailed description that is given there. Just like the in the third verse of the first canto, it describes Shukadeva Goswami. Pivata Bhagavatam Rasam Alayam Muhur Aho Rasika Bhuvi Bhavaka. He is a Rasik devotee. He knew how to relish the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. So much so that not only Sutta is appreciating like that, but even Vyasadeva was appreciating like that. When it came time for Maharaj Pariksit to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasa could have expressed it. But he sat in the audience and listened to Shukadeva Goswami, because the fruit has become even more tasteful, although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls, because it emanated from the lips of Shukadeva Goswami. Rasika Bhakta. He made it, his narrating made it even more relishable. It's just appearing like that. The idea is, how does one become a devotee? By association with devotees. So he was liberated, but in his appearance in this world had not yet associated with a devotee. So he was, as a monist, he was within the womb of his mother for years. Poor mother. So then when hearing, just from hearing, he became a devotee. It's a lila. So that we could then understand the transcendental nature of Srimad Bhagavatam, that just by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, the monist, a Brahmavadi, became a devotee. The Atmaram Sloka, it's a very important verse in the Bhagavatam. So he's appearing that way, detached, but not yet having heard. So it could have, the Leela could have been different, but that's how the Lord chose, and that's how he played it, so he could hear the Bhagavatam, and then with there's no material attraction for Shukadeva Goswami.
So until we really are totally distracted from material things, we cannot relish.
You cannot fully relish, yeah. Or say it in reverse, Shukadeva could fully relish the Bhagavatam because having no material attraction. That's the lesson of the Leela. And that the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, the reverse is, it's fully transcendental because Shukadeva Goswami wouldn't have had any interest in something material. He had no interest in anything material. That he was interested in Srimad Bhagavatam proves it's fully transcendental, although worldly people would look at it otherwise. Oh, it's just about histories of people and generations of men and wars and battles and Krishna's dancing with women. Mundane. Not mundane, Shukadeva Goswami. That's another purpose. Madhvacharya chose to not comment on that chapter of the Bhagavatam. Because in Madhvacharya's line, the glorification of Lord Brahma is like the glorification of the Madhvas for Madhva. He's in a category of his own as far as Madhva's direct commentaries and teachings are concerned. In the case of Lord Brahma, what the hope for us is the same hope for Brahma. Kshipram bhavati dharmatma. Krishna corrected the situation immediately. The situation that Brahma found himself in difficulty, Krishna immediately corrected the situation. And he did it in such a wonderful way. So even while appearing to do something that was quite wrong, Krishna's protection was there. Krishna didn't change his disposition toward Brahma. Sadureva samantavya. Because of Krishna's protection, and Krishna's protection goes to one who is Ananyabhak. That's our hope. Krishna's, in any case, it's Krishna's mercy and Krishna's omnipotency and Krishna's knowing what our sincere desire is. So the real work then needs not go to, gee, what's the hope for us? The real work needs to go to, what's our sincerity? How much do we really want Krishna, like the discussion last night? Well, there's some attraction for Krishna, and frankly there's some attraction for independent enjoyment, and that's the condition. We're mixed in our devotion, so our prayer is that Krishna will see, our hope is that Krishna will see that attraction for him side and help us go further. And the process of devotional service is to help us go further. And if we maintain some attachments even while trying to go further, Krishna may show his special favor and just take it away. That's our hope. From Rupa Goswami's teachings, he calls it hope against hope. Although I'm so unqualified, the Lord is very merciful. And I'm shameless. I have no right to ask for mercy. I'm boldly asking for mercy. I'm counting on it, although I have no qualification. That's our hope. The merciful nature of Krishna. And so we don't spend that equity in the wrong way. We don't draw down upon it. We rely on Krishna's kindness, but we make every precaution on our side to be qualified to receive that mercy. And then meaning we try to act with fullest degree of purity that we can. This question you ask, the whole of Sharanagati. How can we get out of the material condition when we're conditioned and our desire is less than strong, less than what's required? So it's the combination, our Lord Chaitanya's teachings is the combination of our effort and mercy. If it's just dependent upon our effort, you know, it's a losing battle. But it's not just mercy either. We also must make some effort. Krishna sees the effort. And that's our hope. Yeah.
This is about training. So I am mostly getting some training. Now I want to know what are the right questions to ask to get training? Like, what are the components?
There's not a rule book for that.
Yeah.
A couple things I think are appropriate. One is Krishna will provide the intelligence. So what's needed not so much is as guidelines, but as like a really sincere desire. And when the real sincere desire is the right, Krishna will provide the right questions. And then the second part is try to understand what are like foundational principles, and then drill down. Your questions can go to drill down more on those foundational, fundamental principles. Let's say particularly in the application side, or like your question last night, the understanding side. Have I understood? Then the question can be, this is what I'm understanding. Is there something missing here? So, you know, something comes, filters are filtering, you've heard something less than the full thing. Here's what I heard, what part am I missing? So that when I hear the part that I'm missing, right away, it's going to identify where my filters are. Right? And then the challenge is, okay, am I ready to deal with that filter? You know, because that's an attachment. I'm attached to an enjoying spirit in a certain way, and therefore, there's certain things that I just cannot, will not, do not hear. So now we'll go back to what I said the first part. The first part is, do you want to go beyond your conditioning? And it's like I'm not challenging you, I'm saying you challenge yourself. Am I happy being a mixed devotee? Or do I really want to go to beyond being a mixed devotee? Do I want to go to the transcendental life of devotion? Because that's what training can provide the opportunity for. If the answer is yes, then you're ready to go the next step. If the answer is, well, kind of. You know, at least in some areas. Maybe not in some other areas, but at least in some areas. It comes a lot, the proper questions come a lot, not in the information category, but the application category. And the application category depends so much on the quality of the relationships with persons who are guiding you in Krishna consciousness, that they're really meaningful and they're like essential, they're essences, because through the medium of that relationship then one can get the enthusiasm and sustained enthusiasm to go further. The courage, the confidence, the desire through association. When those relationships are strong, then the inspiration will be strong and the sense of confidence will be strong and, you know, the readiness to go another step. And then, I guess the third thing is there's a little bit of common sense involved in all of this, like what the proper questions are. They're empowered. That's the simple answer is they're empowered. There's a mission, and they're empowered to execute the mission. When you read, I've done this, read Bhaktivinoda Thakur's explanation of a certain topic, or even, you know, his commentary on a particular section of Chaitanya Charitamrita or Bhagavatam. How he explains, how Bhaktisiddhanta explains, and how Prabhupada explains. The essences are the same. The personalities are different. The audience is different. The time and circumstance is different. Prabhupada pablamized everything. He took the writings of Jiva Goswami, which are so refined and detailed, and he just like put it, you know, the essences are there. But it's so easy, in language that's so easy, and concepts that are so easy. It's like too easy. There's some people like something that's more challenging. It's just so easy. It's like a smoothie. It's got all your goodies in that smoothie, all the proteins and all the enzymes and yummy. But you know, Prabhupada did like that. He had there's different audiences, and it's empowered. Acharyas are empowered. That's how they do what they do. And how does that empowerment come? Prabhupada explains. Take the instruction of the spiritual master as your life and soul. One who factually does that, Krishna gives empowerment. Formula is simple. Doing it is another thing.
Where we invest consciousness
determines, say it again slower.
Where we invest our consciousness determines the qualities that we get.
Yes, the qualities that we get, yes.
My question was kind of if you could elaborate on what is investing our consciousness mean, because
I gave examples. You know, let's say someone is attracted to the mode of goodness, so they invest consciousness in the path that they follow. When they have it, they're choosing how they're going to live their day or live their life. It's according to virtue. I'm going to stand by the truth no matter what, even if it hurts. That's the quality of goodness. And then it's not, you know, what's politically expedient or not, that's not the consideration. It's something that's true, and I'm going to stand by that. I believe in it, I'm going to stand by it. So that's a quality of goodness. And that's investing of consciousness. That's what I mean. You know, that's something, what does one hold to be valuable? What do you hold as real and important to you? That's where you invest consciousness. Another way of saying the same thing, this is the Vaisheshika way of saying the same thing. It's cute, some little aphorism. Where attention goes, energy flows. That's his saying. So what chitta is consciousness, attention. Where do we place our attention? We choose. Now, there are persons that can be more not present. It appears that they're not making a choice. But that's also making a choice. And then what's being exhibited is the modes of nature. Raw. But there's still a choice involved, even in that. So where's your attention going? So what we want as devotees, the context here is Sukadeva Goswami, whose attention was fully on the transcendental platform. There was no consciousness going to temporal things. Even a naked young boy seeing naked women, his attention didn't go there. Not at all. And the ladies could understand. We have no concern with this fellow. So, from our side, what is it that what's important to us? Where do we invest our consciousness? Let's say, you know, like some discussions related to academic, what about career? Should I do, you know, what? So what's the value structure that you hold? That's where you invest consciousness. And the transcendental, the art of transcendental life is to be responsible in our dealings with the affairs of the world. But where we choose to invest consciousness is in the putting the point, focus, laser point on this is to be for Krishna. So then, because it's for Krishna, the rest becomes illumined. You know, what and how and the details. So it's not a matter of balance, it's a matter of focus. That's where we invest consciousness for a transcendentalist.
So, for example, when chanting, my experience is that I can, for some time, I can focus on the chanting itself.
You're very fortunate.
But there are, for some time, not for the whole thing.
You're very fortunate.
But there is no emotion involved. Meaning, I can, so Prabhupada said, just hear what you're chanting. So I can hear it. But there is no feeling behind it. It's just
mechanical.
It's mechanical focus, but that's the stage I'm in. So another place.
Well, here you want to hear a recommendation?
Yes, ma'am.
Take that very fortunate gift, because some persons don't have it. Take that very fortunate gift and just add to that instruction that you repeated, that Prabhupada said, and add one other thing, chant from the heart. And then, you know, as you're chanting, see where that goes. Because in fact, that's what's going on. You know, the mouth moves, and the lungs move, and you know, the lips move, and the whole, you know, the machine moves because the presence of the soul. The chanting of the holy name is from the soul. We're calling to Krishna. So if the mind can focus on that calling to Krishna, and it's coming from the heart, coming from the soul itself, then you're connecting with Krishna. The feelings will automatically be there. Say this. I'll say the same thing in a different, very different, no, it's not the same thing, it's a very different approach. In one of the Japa retreats that I attended, Niranjan Maharaj was making the point. It was in relation to one of his disciples who had some severe illness, hospitalized, and they stopped their chanting because they were zoned out. And as their health was restoring, they resumed their chanting, and they were saying, now I'm back to X number of rounds. They wanted, you know, they wanted his encouragement to keep going. And his response was, more important than increasing the number of rounds is that whatever level, now that you're reviving, chant with feeling. Because when you chant with feeling, automatically the quantity will increase. And then he was elaborating. You can be take a feeling. Pick a feeling. It can be the feeling, oh, I stopped my chanting. And now I went down to zero, and now I'm back up to eight. So there's a feeling connected with that. The, oh, how unfortunate. Feeling. Chant with feeling. Take that feeling, take another feeling. Pick a feeling. Like, you know, yours could be, I'm not chanting with any feeling. And you're feeling something about having no feeling that when you're chanting. Just stay with it. because that awakens, it's like gratitude awakens love, so chanting with feeling in relation to Krishna will awaken love for Krishna. Whether it's separation or whatever it is, joy, unhappiness. I have no feeling. It will increase focused attention, and it will awaken transcendental feelings. It works. Yeah.
This is related to yesterday's lecture.
Okay.
I'm confused with the words like in the lecture. But, say you being with Krishna, present with Krishna.
Yeah.
See Krishna and praise of Srimad Bhagavatam. Realize Krishna. Experience Krishna.
Okay.
Krishna is reciprocation.
Do any of those come close to resonating? Do you know what it means when someone says, supposing we're having this conversation, and while we're having the conversation, you know, I look out the window and look at my watch, and I'm still talking, and you know, I'm physically. We're together, but my attention, I'm investing consciousness somewhere else. I'm not present with you. And then being present with somebody is you're giving their undivided attention. You're present. You may not have all the answers and all the, but you're present. So being present with Krishna when you're chanting is like that. My realization may be anywhere from 0 to 100, but I'm present with Krishna, and he's striving to be in a very personal way. That's what I mean by being present with Krishna. Or being here's another example. Someone wrote to me recently that for a whole week things would come to them, even their child or a friend would come to visit them in their home, and they were just in this very selfish, reactive space, and they weren't even present with people. People would ask something, and they didn't even respond in a way that satisfied them, or to speak of the other person. They just weren't present. They were absorbed in their own stuff, in the mind, more accurately. And being present means that gets, you know, that goes to the side and you're with the person. At least, you know, you're empathetically receiving what's important to them and reflecting back to them. You've understood, you've connected with what's important to them. That's being present. So when chanting, be present with the holy name. That's what I mean by that. Whatever your life is about, whatever you're processing, you're present with Krishna. You don't do that processing while you're chanting. You're just chanting. You're associating with Krishna. And the magic is, when you give your attention to Krishna like that, He automatically fills in the blanks. You know, what to do about this, what to do about that, this relationship, that problem, this decision. You know, Krishna will take care of that. Be present with Krishna. Just then in the course of, following that in the course of the activities of the day, you're with Krishna's with you, you're with Krishna. He's guiding. You feel it. Because you took the time to be present with Krishna. But it was nothing else going on but that. It's transcendentally amazing to watch that principle being active, or go the other direction where you're not present with Krishna and everything becomes a struggle. Little things become a struggle. Big things become a mountain of struggle. And struggle, struggle, struggle. So Bhagavad Gita verse, Daibiyesha Gunamayi Malamaya Dharatiya Mam Eva Eva Padyante. This is being present with Krishna. I'm just depending on Krishna. I'm giving my undivided attention to Krishna. That's what I mean by that phrase. And seeing, you know, a more elevated stage of realization might be literally seeing Krishna, but seeing Krishna in every page is that subjectively, my experience is from absorption in Srimad Bhagavatam, I described it yesterday, but there's a feeling that Krishna is in your life. You see things, you experience things, you feel things in relation to the message of the Bhagavatam. Like, without even trying, because you gave full attention to the Bhagavatam. And Krishna becomes your best friend. He's with you all the time. You're present with Krishna from that kind of attentiveness to the Srimad Bhagavatam's message. It's seeing the world in a different way. It's magic. But it's as real as anything is real. Because now we're seeing the world, we don't have this other experience in the conditioned state, but in the conditioned state we're seeing the world by a whole other set of things that we've heard and experienced. Because we're conditioned by all of that. And then by associating with Krishna in his literary form, one can experience Krishna's presence. And it's very nice. Very nice. Now, seeing Krishna on the higher level, which it seems that Prabhupada is saying, is literally seeing Krishna. I have no realization of that. Experience means a relationship. Need some oil on those hinges. There are undoubtedly persons in your life that you feel very close to. So think of one or some of those persons that you feel very close to. And when you think of those persons that you're very close to, there's a certain energy, a certain shelter, a certain confidence, a certain comfort in being with those persons, just having the opportunity to be with those persons. So like that with Krishna, the shelter, the protection, the comfort, that just he's with you. You feel Krishna's presence in your life through the medium of hearing and awakening devotion, and through the awakening of devotion, serving. You're always connected wherever you go, whatever the deal is. You know, bad, good, neutral, You feel connection, relationship, through hearing and service. That's this resource, this Srimad Bhagavatam that Prabhupada translated with great sacrifice and made available to us, is to give us that relationship with Krishna through sound and proper hearing. And so when you all get together and discuss and you're sharing, then you're building relationships with one another with Krishna at the center of them. And you're helping one another to do the same, to build a relationship with Krishna. You're serving one another in that way. Very nice. And Krishna recognizes the effort, and so Krishna reciprocates with that effort. So he helps individually and collectively, just by the sacrifice of placing Krishna at the center. It's magic. Because let's say, you know, there's a group of other students, they don't have this medium. What's the medium? It's their academics or individual or collective sense gratification with one another. And that's what goes on. There's no Krishna in the picture because there's no Bhagavatam providing that medium for sharing with one another. And then when Krishna comes in the picture, sense gratification proportionately fades. And then there's wholesome relationships where it's not what you're getting from the other person. And that's our relationship. I give something to you and you give something to me. Sense gratification, and we're friends. That just, all that very cosmetic so-called relationship thing disappears. The devotees have much more deep appreciation and value in one another's association. That will go far beyond, you know, your undergraduate or graduate years of college. It continues. You value that association in an enduring way, because it's in relation to Krishna. And so you're feeling Krishna's presence in that relationship. And it grows as you mature in Krishna consciousness. Anything? Just give a little turnover on this side. Yeah.
Can you explain what it means to have the conception of concept of the expression of the
meaning? Well, it's a little bit like what Shukadev, what Sutta, excuse me, what Shonika is saying about Sutta. Now, there are certainly, there are material things about preceptors and mentors and spiritual masters. They have bodies, they have personalities, they have ways that they do things, and so on. Go beyond that, what's the essence? The essence is, there's attachment for Krishna. And through their personality, they're passing on their attachment to Krishna and assisting us to get our attachment for Krishna. So that's the spiritual conception. It's the Krishna connection conception. And so now we'll go back to their particular ways of doing things. Ashram specific, quality specific, personality specific. Minus Krishna, it's just mundane. With Krishna, it's unique. So we can appreciate, like let's say we can appreciate the mood. Here's something, because I've been narrating it recently. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu decided that he was going to take sannyas, according to Chaitanya Bhagavat, he informed a handful of people. Like, that's five. And when he informed Nityananda, he responded one way. When he informed Gauridas Pandit, he responded in a very different way. Gauridas Pandit's response was, "Why don't you just kill me? How can you do this?" Like chastising him. "You're taking sannyas means you leave Puri, you leave Mayapur, you leave Navadvip, and I'll not have your association. You're my life and soul, and you're going to take sannyas? Just kill me." Practically crying. That's his personality. His particular love, or Jagatananda Pandit. What sandalwood oil? And right in front of him, smashed the pot of sandalwood oil and splattered all over the floor and went to his room and locked the door and pouted. That's his personality. It's his particular relationship. So what's being exhibited, the essence is attachment to Lord Chaitanya. And there are differences of moods and ways of expressing that attachment, but the essence is that attachment. So it's not that your attachment needs to be their attachment mood, but appreciate there's particulars, and it's fully transcendental for pure devotees. So how to see a mentor and a spiritual master is the essence is how they're attached to Guru and Krishna. And I am getting the opportunity through that association to similarly develop. That's a spiritual conception of what that relationship is. And it comes in particular ways. We all are personalities. We're going to express ourselves in different ways. Well, what's the essence? And Krishna is providing this opportunity. He's sending this resource. He's sending that resource. They're sent by Krishna. That's a spiritual conception too. What's behind them? Krishna's kindness. And it's coming in this form. Does that help? Well, if things aren't working out, what does that mean? Does that mean Krishna's wrong, or they're wrong, or I'm wrong? If there's something that's coming out short, it may not be that any one of us are wrong, that just Krishna wants to see my determination become stronger. You know, that's if that's to say, when Prabhupada came to America, it wasn't coming out right. But how was he to process that? Bhaktisiddhanta made a mistake. Krishna made a mistake, or I'm not qualified to fulfill this instruction. Krishna was testing his determination. Sometimes we're not on that platform, but sometimes that's the situation. It's not coming out right. So let me go over here to my relationship with Krishna. And am I saying yes to Krishna, or maybe to Krishna? Or no to Krishna? What's my relationship with Krishna? Forget about, you know, whether it's coming out right or not. What's my relationship with Krishna? And the resources Krishna is sending is to help come to the stage where it's acceptance. When that saying yes to Krishna takes place, genuinely, fully, the configuration of matter starts to move. Sometimes the configuration of matter is because there's a block over here. We want Krishna's arrangement to be how we want Krishna's arrangement to be, not how he's presenting it. The problem isn't the arrangement, the problem is our conception of what the arrangement should be. Maybe something Krishna is sending your way for your elevation, your edification, your purification, your strengthening of your determination, so many things. Remember when Krishna Leela conducted that seminar in Gita Nagari, Say Yes to Krishna? Very, very useful. Everybody got a Say Yes to Krishna button. The first exercise was it got to be hilarious. What are things that are happening in your life you don't like? You wish it was different. And, 6 pages of flip charts were filled and people were laughing and laughing and laughing. Because they said, yeah, I know that one and I know that one. And okay, I think we have enough. Now, how to change the I don't like it to say yes to Krishna? And because there's something intended in each of those 6 pages of things for us to grow. It's not that it isn't coming out right. We're not ready to grow. Because we're like children, we want it to be like this, not like that. And that's all we can see. We can't see beyond whether we get our lollipop or we have to take some medicine. But on the other side, Krishna is saying, that you need to grow in a certain way. Come on, Vidya, grow. That isn't what I want. I was on the flight. I learned a lot on airplanes. On the flight from Delhi to Chicago, I had an aisle seat, and right over here on the opposite aisle was a woman, in the middle was their little girl, in the middle was the father. And the little girl had her mother and father completely wrapped around her little finger. She just had to whine and complain, and immediately she had attention from both sides, finding out what the whining complaining was about, and they had a doll and a toy and a this and a that and a book and stories. And she was a little princess that had complete control over her mother and father. The girl was completely spoiled. They were trying, I took it, that they were trying to show their affection. But I could also see that she was completely spoiled. So let us not be the completely spoiled, it's got to be my way, or something over there, or over there, or something else is wrong. There are lessons that we need to grow. Krishna is giving us situations that are going to help us grow. And our faith in him, and our ability to depend on him, and our understanding of nature, and of God consciousness, and so many things. We can still make our choices of where there's limits of how much I can take at a time in a certain way and so on. That's fine. That's part of growing also. Krishna's there. Krishna knows. challenges are and what our limitations are, what our abilities are, how we need to mature in different ways, how we need to strengthen our dependence on Him in different ways, how we need to access resources that He's sending us rather than acting independently all the time, or more than need be. So many things. So now back to like this core thing, when relationships are right, that those which are sustaining our Krishna consciousness are right, we can face anything. There's empowerment. There's shelter. And Krishna is not going to send something our way that's it's going to flatten us, like just steamroll us and level us and finish us. There may be some things from our side that we need to do. We put up some boundaries and say, you know, here's some rules, so on. That's good. That's part of maturing too. Trust in Krishna. The idea of say yes to Krishna doesn't mean, you know, our intelligence goes to sleep. We use our intelligence. We take guidance in how to apply your intelligence in different situations that Krishna sends our way while we're saying yes to Krishna. Yes. Let's close, okay. This oily, squeaky hinges are... Let's start again.
So the spiritual perception of looking at the special master and the mentor, I want to know, should there be a line between... in the relationship between... I don't know how I can put it, but I want to know the limits that I have to maintain when I am in a relationship with my peers or with the other Vaishnavas.
The limits? What do you mean by the limits?
Because
I don't know, don't say because. I want to know what you mean by that term. The limits? Like where limits generally means where it begins and ends. It's a relationship. So I don't know what you mean by limits.
In a sense, there are certain things that we need guidance for, and there are certain things which maybe we don't need guidance for, but we don't have confidence in carrying out those things without the guidance. So I tend to depend a lot on people because of the trust I have in them. But I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing, because that's when I say maybe I shouldn't go too much.
Maybe you shouldn't go too much?
I shouldn't ask too much.
Oh. It sounds like there's something particular that you're thinking about and I can't read between the lines, but I can describe principles. And principles mean, it says that when it comes to making decisions, you have to make your own decisions. The function of someone guiding you in your spiritual life is not to make your decisions for you, to make your choices for you, even like your bigger ones or smaller ones. You make your choices, and then you bear the responsibility for the consequences of those choices, because they're your choices. So where you can go or don't go, you know, what areas that you may go seek advice or guidance. The range is not limited other than common sense. But the areas of life which you can seek guidance from, it's the whole range of ideas, the whole range of things that we do in our life. But then the decisions are your decisions. So you say, depending, that I depend on a lot of people for good advice, but I know that I have to make decisions. There are all types of devotees that I turn to seek advice from. They're not exactly gurus or mentors, but they're persons who I look up to as wise. And if your question is what's the range of topics that I can go to, other than common sense, I don't see a limit. I mean, you don't ask, do I put my left shoe on first or my right shoe on first? So there's limits of the kinds of questions one asks, just by common sense. But the decision is your decision when it comes to making decisions. Part of one of the major functions of someone guiding is how to make wise decisions. And part of the how to make wise decisions consideration is when you look at any decision, anything that you need to decide, there's pluses and minuses. The other option has pluses and minuses. All the other options have pluses and minuses. Now, how do I weigh out the pluses and minuses? When you seek guidance, it's not, can you make the decision for me? Because I can't make I can't see the right decision. Someone that's guiding you shouldn't make the decision for you. They should help you understand how to make a wise decision, so that you, in turn, as you mature in your life, and as we discussed last night, things become more complex, not more simple, then you'll have the criterion, you'll have the skill set to make wise decisions and to train others who are depending upon you to make wise decisions, because you've been taken through that process yourself. Yeah? Yeah. Well, sorry, Charlie. It will come. Okay, then don't get married and don't have children. And don't have friends. Don't grow up, just stay a little girl. That's not realistic. Okay, you look pretty sad, but you know, the reality is, and that requirement will come. In life. So, if you know, don't say no to Krishna. Okay, here's a situation that I'm feeling, gee, I wish I really didn't have to do that. Now, when the situation, how can you look at that situation differently? Krishna is providing you an opportunity for serving him. It's not like having a power position over somebody. That's not it. It's serving Krishna. You're a servant. Constitutionally a servant. So don't say no when Krishna gives you some service. You may say, I need to understand how to do this service in the right mood. But that's part of where training comes. You carefully observe how someone is training you, and then you can understand this is what it means to train. And training isn't like, again, it's not a power position. It's just a service. That's all it is. It's the same thing that Sutta is doing. He heard with rapt attention. He says, with rapt attention. So this is what you need to do. You hear with rapt attention from a qualified person, and you carefully try to understand what is that message. Just like this dialogue right now, what's the message? Okay, I'm a servant, and I don't want to change, edit, or delete the message. I want to receive the message, and then in the realm of the world of action, see how this message can be applied so I can do that in a mode of service. And that's relationship. On the receiving end of this, you know, goes to your question yesterday, what about the giving end? And you're saying no? But you're saying no. So that's part of gratitude, that you say yes, because there's gratitude. You're receiving something. Now, what's my obligation that I've received something? And don't, you know, so at least put the pause button on no and say, okay, how can I process this differently? And the answer is in the mood of service. Not in the mood of control, not in the mood of power, in the mood of service.
I'll stop with this question at once. There are two connections to this. When you have that, because I've seen that I still don't know so much, and I come across so many people who want to know about Krishna consciousness, and I run away. And I run away and come to people who I think can be better. The fear is that I've got so much, I've learned so much, will I be able to give exactly the same? And the second fear is that...
This is the answer to that is... Rely on Krishna, and it's not, you're not the doer, you're an instrument. The problem is false ego. And the problem is you're carrying this false ego conception in your mind, and that's what's getting in the way. That's what's getting in the way. So, take your time. It's not like, you know, the clock is running and the buzzer is going to sound and you're in the penalty box if you don't do it before the buzzer sounds. But let go of this doership mentality and take the servant mentality. When someone that you meet that has wants to learn something about Krishna consciousness, you put on your, take off your ego hat and put on your servant hat. And you can say to, you know, within yourself you can say, I'm this neophyte bungler. But I've got my servant cap on, and so I'm going to express. These are things that I've learned. And I find they're really wonderful. It's not above your realization. You're not putting yourself down either. You're pumping yourself up. You're just, these are things that I've learned. I find they're very wonderful. Just be honest. When I can remember in your stage, as a college student, people asking such and such and such and such things. And I said, it's very similar. I don't know about all of that, but here's something I understand. You know, chanting is really helping me. And I really like Bhagavad Gita. There are lots of things in Bhagavad Gita that I surely haven't understood, but it's some very, very valuable things. And on the point that you're asking, here's what I understand and what I've heard. Very exciting. It's all very honest. You're not in, you know, fixing their problem mentality. That's Maya. Just sharing. Don't run away from sharing. It's just in the mood of service. That's all. Okay. Whew. 9:30. Shilapad ki jai.